It's really rare in this day and age for people to stay in the same careers throughout their working lives. So changing jobs, changing careers is common, expected even. But some career changes are more jarring than others. Our guest this hour offers an example. Camis Davis went from the magazine business to food, and not by opening a store. She took up butchery, hence the picture of a meat cleaver on the front of her book. It's called Killing It, an Education. Camis Davis used to write and edit magazines, including Savour and National Geographic Adventure. Now she's the owner of the Portland Meat Collective and the executive director of the Good Meat Project. How she got from one career to the other is what we'll talk about in the hour ahead. Camis Davis, a pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You start on the kill floor at a slaughterhouse. A year or two before, would you ever have expected to be in such a place?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I think maybe a year or two before, I had thought it would be interesting to learn a little butchery, just dabble, but I had never imagined I would be in an abattoir or a kill floor.
And what were you feeling as you were standing there watching the process go on?
It was intense and overwhelming and also surprising in many ways. I think I had grown up with certain ideas about how it's done and what it looks like and what it should feel like. And this particular kill floor didn't really meet up to those assumptions in good ways. It was very quiet. It was calm. Everyone was very serious about their work. It was respectful. It was quick. And so that was surprising to me.
Not a loud, clattery factory floor. Is that what you had expected?
No, it was a very, very small abattoir or a kill floor. And so, you know, they were moving maybe 20 or 30 animals in a day. So they had the time to take care in what they were doing and do it right.
You draw some parallels in the book between the sow being killed and you. She was about to be butchered because her useful life as something other than food had ended. What had happened to you?
It was 2009, and I had been laid off from my job at a city magazine in Portland, Oregon. And that was after about a 10-year career in magazine editing and writing. So I felt like my purpose had ended, and yet I didn't know what I was going to do moving forward or what was going to happen to me.
There's a great description of your seatmate, the person sitting next to you on the flight to France, his eyes widening as you explain that you were magazine editor on your way to study butchery. And then at this point, the reader's eyes widen too. Why? I mean, so you mentioned dabbling in it, but this was more of a dedication you were about to undertake, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I think most people were surprised, at least in America where I was and also on the plane to France, because it's a trade that no one sees anymore. We don't see evidence of it anymore. Most butchery is done not in butcher shops or behind the grocery store counter, but in processing facilities, you know, three states over that we don't have access to. And so we have a nostalgic notion of what a butcher looks like, and usually that's a large man and not me. And at the same time, we don't really know what to envision because we don't see it anymore. So I think for some people it seemed like an old-fashioned choice. For other people it seemed like a gruesome choice. And certainly because I'm a woman, it seemed like an out-of-the-ordinary choice.
You explain in the book, though, that you do have some history with unorthodox decisions. Can we get a sampler?
Yeah. Let's see. I worked in a women's prison teaching creative writing when I was 19. I went to Nicaragua to organize migrant farm workers. I quit my magazine job briefly to study performance studies, which is sort of like a cross between theater and anthropology. Lived on the coast, worked in a domestic violence shelter for a while. So I often chose the hard route.
Okay, but you're willing to learn a few things along the way, clearly.
Yeah. I often make my choices based on how many questions I have and go from there.
You have quite a history, Camis, it appears, with the animals as food. Did you hunt and fish as a kid?
Yeah, I grew up outside of Eugene, Oregon, and I hunted and fished with my grandfather and my dad. We duck hunted and goose hunted. We fished in reservoirs and rivers and lakes. I didn't really go deer hunting and elk hunting with them because I was too young and impatient, but I certainly saw evidence of it, and we certainly ate the venison that they killed. It was a part of my growing up, for sure. And then eventually I kind of drifted from that and forgot about those processes.
It's interesting to see the differences between your parents, though, because your dad hunted, as you pointed out. What was your mom's thought about meat?
Well, she often said if she wasn't married to my father, she would be a vegetarian. She didn't like the idea of my dad, quote-unquote, killing Bambi, as she would say, although my dad would never kill Bambi. And she also didn't really like, she cooked our food, she cooked the meat for us, but she didn't like to touch raw meat or even really see it. So those reminders of where meat came from didn't fit well with her.
Yeah, you were a vegetarian yourself for a while, which is not unusual in Eugene. We do have an audience in Eugene. What got you back to meat?
Mostly laziness, honestly. I was in my teenage years and in my college years, and I wasn't very good at making up for the protein and the iron that I had lost in dropping meat, and became anemic, lost a lot of weight. I mean, I just wasn't a very responsible vegetarian. And also, I just, the allure of meat pulled me back, and which is not necessarily worthy or a good reason to stop being a vegetarian, but that is what happened to me, and that's, I think, what happens to a lot of people.
All right, we have much more to talk about with Camis Davis, her book about leaving the magazine business, not voluntarily, and then taking up another pursuit in the field of butchery is detailed in her memoir, Killing It, an Education. She gets an education, and we get an education reading the book about all she's learned, stuff that she shares now through the Portland Meat Collective and the Good Meat Project, which we'll talk about later in the hour. And we'll come back and talk more with Camis Davis, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Camis Davis, who was in the magazine business for a good bit of her adult life and abruptly changed, not entirely by her own choice. She was laid off from a publication in Portland in 2009 and decided to go into the food business. And by this, I don't mean making salad spinners or something. She decided she was going to learn butchery and did. And she tells the story in her book, Killing It, an Education. And she also went on to found the Portland Meat Collective and the Good Meat Project. We'll talk about those as well in the hour. You can join the conversation on the exchange if you have questions or comments for Camis as we go along. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Camis, I thought your first name was very Oregonian, and it is. How did your parents come to this?
They always disagree with how I tell the story, but the story I tell, even though I wasn't there at the time, is that they drove by Camis' sign on I-5 going south out of Eugene that said Camis Swale, and they said, oh, Camis is kind of a great name, but we don't want to name her after a ditch, which is basically what a swale is. And then later on, when they were still pregnant with me, they came upon a field of purple wildflowers and found out it was the Camis flower and decided to name me after the flower and the ditch.
Okay, I was thinking of Camis Valley when I first heard the name, and if anybody's wondering, Camis Valley is west of Winston between 10 Mile and Remote. So not exactly an Oregon metropolis. Have you been to Camis Valley?
I think I have at some point, yes. There's many locales in Oregon and even in Washington that are named after Camis, so I often see my name on signs in the Pacific Northwest.
That must be fun. Have you ever eaten Camis bulbs?
I haven't yet. It's on my bucket list.
Okay.
I'm probably the only person with that on my bucket list.
Could be. So what were some of the events in your earlier life that turned you toward journalism, toward the magazine editing positions that you ended up with?
I think from an early age, I asked a lot of questions and was, I was probably one of those annoying kids.
Why?
Who asked why too many times to their parents.
Right.
So I just tended towards asking questions. And then I also had, for much of my adolescence, really been a bit of an activist in a way. I mean, I you know, worked with migrant farm workers in Woodburn, Oregon, and worked often within the agricultural sector down in Central America as well. And even back then, sort of saw the ways in which food can become politicized, and food is really the basis for everything, and is important. And so even though I didn't really understand it totally back then, I think I had a sense for those systems needing more attention paid to them, for sure.
Were you able to steer coverage in your magazine? Well, obviously in Savour, it's all about food. So.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the magazine industry and doing food writing at a time when it was not so focused on those systems and how they might be broken or need help. It was more just about food as pleasure and food, learning culture through food. And so that consciousness about food, I think, came much later for me.
So it was not like Savour ever did things about, you know, knowing your farmer or stuff like that while you were there?
Not so directly. I think at the time, this was 2002, 2003, that was sort of just becoming part of journalism and food writing. And, you know, Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan wasn't even out yet. So that language was just starting to be developed at that point.
All right. Didn't talk about locavores and things like that at that time.
Not
sure.
Yet. I don't think we even had that phrase in our vocabulary.
So, subject matter aside, you had a great resume when you left New York City for Portland. Why did you leave New York City for Portland?
It was some hard living I was doing there. I was in my 20s. I was working 12, 14-hour days, not getting paid very much, and I was living the dream of being a magazine editor. But I missed Oregon, and I missed my home, and I missed a slower pace and a slower life, and just felt like my quality of life kept going down, and there was not much payoff over time.
So it sounds like at the magazine in Portland, you had a few unplanned visits to the editor-in-chief's office. What got you guys off on the wrong foot and kept you there?
Oh, I don't know. I think having worked for magazines as long as I did, I came to understand that when you get a new editor-in-chief, everything is turned upside down and everyone is tested and many people are let go because the editor-in-chief wants to do their own thing and start everything anew. And so me being vocal and asking questions and somewhat defiant.
So you're still the why girl, you're saying?
Yes, I would ask too many whys. So it didn't... It did not end well, per se, but it was also at a time in my life in which I was feeling very burnt out on what I was doing, and I wasn't really finding a lot of meaning in what I was doing. So in some ways, I might have been subconsciously making that occur.
Yeah, forcing the issue a little bit. Yeah.
Camis
Davis is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Killing It, in Education, about her move from journalism to butchery. So not long after she canned you, you're standing in France. This is actually a rather lovely, serene moment in the book. You were feeling relief at not being a journalist.
Yeah, when I went to, right before I went to France, I actually had a lot of my editor friends heard what I was doing and said, you know, we'd love for you to write a story or an essay about your time there. And I said no to all of those requests, even though I knew it was a great story. And I said no because I really wanted to experience it all without spinning it into the media mindset, into a good headline and a good story. I had felt over time like that mindset had prevented me from just having real, true, meaningful experiences in my life. And I needed to let that go for a bit.
In the sense that you couldn't just live the moment, you had to also be examining the moment for its potential?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes sense. So talk about how you chose Gascony and the people you chose to go to for training.
Well, through my time at the City Magazine in Portland, I had met a man named Robert Reynolds and written a story about him. He was sort of an underground Francophile chef who sort of secretly taught a lot of the now very famous chefs in Portland in his home kitchen, and very poetic man. And he often would take his students to Gascony. So I'd hear all these stories about Gascony. And then he introduced me to a woman named Kate Hill, an American woman who had been living in Gascony for about 20 years and made it her life's work in a way to connect people like lost people like me with the producers and the chefs and the farmers in that region to learn sort of a Gascon way of raising food and eating it and enjoying it. And so after I lost my job, I started thinking about butchery, and her name kind of popped into my head as someone who might not flinch when I called her up and said, could you find me some pig farmers and butchers and hook me up with them? And she indeed did not flinch.
So it sounds like she runs a bit of a refugee home for people who've lost their careers and want to get into the food business.
In a way, yeah. I mean, most of her clients are pay her for that. I just happen to be someone who didn't have money and was convincing enough that she let me sort of come and trade for working for her and helping her prep her home and her classroom for her students. But yeah, it was just a constant cast of people, mostly from America, but also from other parts of the world, who seemed disillusioned, lost, who loved food, but felt they couldn't find a real, genuine sort of sense of food and where it comes from, wherever they lived. And so they came to France to learn that from Kate and her sort of cast of characters and producers and farmers.
You mentioned that Kate didn't flinch, but I do wonder how unusual your request was, Camus. I mean, I can imagine other people coming and saying, "I want to learn how to use herbs better, how to grow a great garden, or how to milk a cow and make great cheese." But I mean, I can't imagine that many people come to her and say, "I want to learn how to butcher a hog."
Yeah, I think one other person, a young man, had asked her maybe 2 years before me or a year before me, and I was the second to ask, and so. Yes, I mean, in some ways I was an anomaly, but she sort of didn't, she seemed to understand why I would want to do that. And I think it was in a time period in which there was just starting to be an inkling of interest in whole animal butchery and meat in general in the food writing world. And so I think she kind of sensed that there was something there that she could move forward with in terms of education.
I should point out, we did have somebody else on talking about butchery within the last 2 years. And so, yes, I mean, that was another person who wrote a book and lives right here in Southern Oregon. And so,
would that be Adam Danforth by chance?
Yes, actually it was.
Yeah. He and I work together often.
Okay, yeah, he's a really fascinating book, and it's interesting. You know, if you get the flinch factor out of it, this is something that gets a little easier to talk about.
Absolutely.
So again, our guest is Kate Davis, Camus Davis, rather. I got you confused with Kate Hill there for a second. Camus Davis was in the magazine business and chose, after she got laid off in Portland, to take a different tack and learn how to butcher animals. Her book is called Killing It, an Education. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We got a hint of this already because the opening vignette of the book I mentioned is about watching a sow be butchered, and it's a very calm sort of thing. It's not a big noisy factory floor, but give us a broader sense, if you would, Camus, about how different the food industry in France is from what you know goes on in the United States.
Well, I mean, what goes on in the United States also goes on in France, of course, but where I was in Gascony in southwest France, I was only learning from very small producers. I often say there's a statistic that's often thrown around, which says anywhere from 97% to 99% of animals raised for food in the industrial world are factory farmed. And I usually say that the people I was working with in Gascony were that other 1% to 3%. So they're working outside of the industrial model. They're, you know, the Chapelards, the pig farmers that I lived and worked with, were only raising about 500 pigs a year. And all of the food from those pigs didn't go further than maybe 300 or 400 miles, if that, from where they raised those animals. So it was a very different model, a much smaller model, an artisanal model. And it was also a model that very much, yes, they were about efficiency, but they were also about the quality of life for the animals, the quality of the meat for the people who ate it, and also about owning the entire process and being able to tell their consumers exactly what happened to the animal at any point in that process of turning it into food.
I get the sense that there's not much waste here, that there is not much of these hogs that ends up not getting used in some form of food.
There was none. And, you know, I've since learned that the factory industrial model is also very good at not wasting anything. But the difference is that the Chapelards were using every part of the pig for food, other than the bones, which they burned and used as compost. Whereas in the industrial model, much of the animal is used for something other than food.
So let me get outside the production and get to the consumption end, because, you know, the French reverence for food at least appears to be universal to the rest of the world, at least to our part of the world. But, I mean, is it like that? I mean, does nobody wolf down a crappy sandwich at a desk while they're working?
I'm sure that there are people who do that in France, but where I was, that did not ever occur so far as I can remember. Meals were long. They were a very important part of the day. I mean, even when I was working 8-hour days in the cutting room with the Chapelards, they still took time to have an hour and a half lunch, and maybe even a nap afterwards. And the interesting thing to me about the meals that I shared with all of these people was that they were long. The amount that they ate was much less than what I was used to eating in America. And they savored it. They didn't eat it quickly. And they also, the meat on the table was almost always an accent. It was never the main course. And if it was part of the main course, it was in the form of a couple pieces of sausage or cured ham or that sort of thing. So they really ate a lot less meat than I was used to seeing in America as well.
I guess I got a little wistful reading this section of the book, because there's a sense of actually enjoying what's on the table in front of you and not just having it be a reason to have a social gathering or something. I mean, you're enjoying each other's company, but you're really enjoying the food too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of the discussion was about the food and how it was raised and why it tasted the way it did. And, yeah, there was just a reverence for it. And it was really, it felt like a right to have this on the table. But there was also the sense that we all worked hard for this. We all, you know, an animal's life was taken for this food, that the amount we paid for this food and the amount of time we took to cook it was perfectly reflected the value of that food. And here in America, and in most industrialized countries, I think that value is seldom well understood, and that we're not usually willing to pay the full value for food that's raised like it was in Gascony.
Camice Davis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Killing It in Education. So we've already talked a little bit about the Chapelard family, Dominique and Christiane and other members of the family. Their involvement with their pig sounds total. I mean, how involved are they with every phase of their animals' lives?
They were a fully vertically integrated business or operation. So they grew the grain to feed their pigs on their farm. They raised the pigs and spent every day with their pigs. They cooperatively owned a slaughterhouse with other small farmers in the region. They didn't do the kills themselves. They hired someone who would professionally did that, but they were present in the slaughterhouse when it occurred. And then they did all of the cutting, the butchery of the animals and transforming it into fresh cuts and charcuterie. And they did all of the selling of it at 4 outdoor markets. So they were there every step of the way. And it was very clear to me that their customers came to them because of that, because they wanted to buy from someone who could vouch for every part of that process.
Which made me wonder, too, do the Chapelards name their animals or otherwise get to know them while they're alive? Or is some sense of removal helpful to the butchering process at the end?
They did not name their animals, so far as I knew. And I would say they were very practically minded about their purpose. But that did not mean that they then treated them poorly or didn't have sort of a philosophy about how they should be raised and how they should live their lives. And here in America, with the farmers that I work with, I find that who are kind of like the Chapelards, or they're trying to raise animals outside of the industrial model, I do find that they're a little, they can be, if they're very small, a little more personal with their animals. They do often name their animals. So that was a difference, I would say.
Are the Chapelards, are they a dying breed? I mean, is there fewer and fewer operations like theirs in France now, too?
Yes, they are. They absolutely are. And they we're very involved in trying to make sure that laws and regulations and policies continue to be passed in France that would support that kind of model. But they often talk to me about how happy they were to see a young person like me come and want to learn this stuff, because a lot of the young people in France did not want to learn that. And so they were unsure of what would happen to their land and their farm, you know, once they retired. And they were very, I didn't really understand until a few years later how unique and rare the Chapelard's model was in France in general.
Is there some reluctance to do what you did even within France? The food attitudes are different, but I wonder if the food production attitudes are the same, if people are a little grossed out by thinking about this food was once alive.
Yeah, I mean, I think the closer you get to cities anywhere, the more prevalent that attitude is, and that was definitely the same in France. But there was still, I don't know, that reverence and that respect that I saw in Gascony has been sort of sewn into the cultural fabric of France in a way that it hasn't been in other countries. So it'll be slower to die if it does die.
Much more to talk about, a lot more questions for Camus Davis on her book, Killing It, An Education. And we'll get a little more detail about her travel to the butchery process when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Oregon-raised Camus Davis. Her first name should give you a clue to how Oregon-born and bred she is. Camus Valley, Camus Swale, the Camus Flower, that is where her name comes from. She was a Marriott magazine editor in New York and then in Portland, and was laid off from her job in Portland and decided it was time for a big change in careers, and so headed off to France, to Gascony in particular, to become a butcher, to learn how to do butchery. And it not only stuck, but she has since started the Portland Meat Collective and the Good Meat Project. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about some value added to animals through butchery. If you're a vegetarian, this is probably not your kind of discussion, but we're learning a lot here. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, as you know, you edited a food magazine. I haven't asked how good you are in the kitchen, Camus.
Bad. I have a good intuition, I suppose, but I always feel I have a lot to learn.
So this is where we get into some of the secrets revealed in the book. If pulled pork is on an American menu and pulled pork is in quotes, what is it really?
Well, in the book, I'm using that in reference to a particular restaurant in Portland who would always have quote unquote pulled pork on the menu. And as a restaurant reviewer, I of course had to ask why were the quotes? Why was pulled pork in quotes? And the chef revealed to me that it was actually head cheese or pâté de tête, and that he, of course, couldn't say that on the menu, so he would just disguise it as pulled pork.
You know, I remember looking at head cheese in the grocery store as a kid, asking my mother, what is this? And I don't remember the explanation she gave me, but your explanation stuck. Head cheese is really what it sounds like.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think we assume that head cheese is basically brain, but it's actually not. It's the head of a pig has, like every other part of the animal, fat and meat and skin and bone on it. And so the resourceful types have figured out a way long ago to take that fat and meat and skin and cook it down for a long period of time, and then sort of press it into a pâté, and it's actually not that scary. It's like any other part of the animal, really, that we eat. But because it comes from the part of the animal that reminds us that it came from an animal, I think we're a little nervous about it in these modern times.
Well, that's the point of the book, too. And it's a lovely moment, really, when Dominique Chapelard asks you what's wrong with eating brains and the other parts that seem to gross Americans out. And what was your answer?
I said, you know, I think it reminds people that the meat they're eating comes from animals and they don't want to be reminded. And, you know, he sort of kept saying, why would you choose to eat an animal and not eat every part? It very much confused him that was a choice that people would make. And it's a very good question. And I think, you know, we choose not to eat certain parts because of that reminder. But in fact, that's a very wasteful way to eat meat. And it means that we demand a very small amount of the animal for food. And we have to have a system that then can produce that much meat to satisfy our cravings or our acceptance of, you know, bacon and real pulled pork and pork chops.
Yeah, those are the thoughts that are crossing my mind, is that if you insist that, well, I only want to eat this part of the animal, then you're letting the rest of the animal go to waste, which then requires more animals.
Absolutely. And that's really the growing number of what, you know, are now called whole animal butchers in restaurants and in grocery stores and butcher shops. I mean, their goal is really that, to create a consumer base that is willing to eat every part and to really think about what that means and what system, good or bad, they're contributing to.
So once you got to pick up a cleaver and knives and all the other tools of the trade, was there any part of it that troubled you particularly? I mean, we already established you had some experience hunting and fishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly became clear to me that there are ways to mitigate unnecessary suffering and pain for the animals that are being raised for food. And that became important to me, the notion of humane animal husbandry and also humane slaughter, which is a hard concept for a lot of people to wrap their head around. I think there are assumptions made that all slaughter is horribly painful and violent and awful. And my experience is that it's not all that way, and it doesn't have to be that way. So that, I started thinking about that a lot early on. And over time, I also started thinking about what are ways in which animal husbandry can actually help sort of regenerate the soil and regenerate the environment and actually be good for us and for the planet. And that I'm still learning about, but I have now come to meet farmers who are really thinking about how do you use grazing animals to make the soil healthy again and to make the soil able to capture carbon and all sorts of things that are really interesting and promising, I think.
And are there any particular animals that you think are better than others for this kind of attention? I know every time we talk about meat and butchery, which is not admittedly that often, or at least about meat, somebody raises the carbon footprint of a cow and how much in the way of resources has to go into to making a pound of beef.
Yeah, well, what I've learned is that it really depends. I mean, those data sets really depend on how exactly that cattle is raised. And if they're grain fed and they're in a factory farm setting, that has very different outputs than truly grass fed beef that is raised in regenerative ways and holistic ways. And I'm talking in general terms here because it would take us many hours to go into the science of it, but that there are other ways to raise animals for food that don't have the same impacts. On the other side of that, if we were to raise animals in those ways, we would also need to eat much less meat. I mean, in general, we need to eat less meat. But I think if we're going to raise animals in the ways that we should, the cost is going to be higher. And we're just not going to be able to raise as many animals to meet the demand. So it sort of requires a wholesale cultural change on both the consumer side and on the agricultural side.
So you've really been thinking about this, both micro and macro. I mean, right from the edge of the knife to the whole ecosystem, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still learning. It's a long process of learning for me.
So back to the edge of the knife then, Camus, you did not cringe, you report, but there's quite an analysis of what cringing itself does to us as human beings, which I found fascinating. What do you see in a problem with cringing for us?
I over time grew to think of the cringe as a way to remove ourselves from our own responsibility in the process. I think the cringe allows us to not know and not see all of the ways in which meat and food gets to our table, and that's dangerous, that allows a certain system to run rampant. And it also doesn't make for very creative thinking about what an alternative system of meat production or food production could be. And it sort of just allows us to exit out of the equation. And I think that's not very responsible and ultimately not that fulfilling in one's life. I certainly felt that way going into this.
So our level of squeamishness prevents us from having honest discussions about the things we could be doing to make things better.
Absolutely.
So what was the hardest thing you'd say to learn just in the actual practical aspects of butchery, not the philosophical parts?
I think the hardest thing was just, and it sounds sort of naive, but actually just being able to understand the anatomy of the animal that I was working on. It really at first just looks like a mass of meat, and that's it. There's no nuances in what I was seeing. And it took me a good year, maybe 2 years, to really be able to look at an animal, understand how all the moving parts work together, why it had this much fat over here and not very much over here, and just think about it in a more meaningful way. And then there were a lot of the butchery that I learned was surprisingly quite graceful and light, and didn't require a lot of brute force, which I had gone into it thinking that's what all butchery was. But there was a little, there was some muscle learning I had to do in terms of using a saw and a cleaver and being able to kind of confidently use those tools in graceful ways and in efficient ways.
Did you hurt yourself much?
I've cut myself quite a few times, for sure. And then after I became a teacher, of course, talking and butchering is never a good idea. So I continue to cut myself every once in a while.
Okay. I want to talk more about the teaching and butchering, but right now I want to welcome in a call from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Camus Davis.
Good morning.
Hi.
I share your love of France and long lunches, Bible-less lunches in my case. But I question a little your idea that the French are that much more aware about their food, because I was put off considerably, especially in that part of the world that you were hanging out in, and I'm sure you were also eating things like pâté de foie gras. And that isn't consistent with a humane race. And the French, I think, are appalling with their animals. And I've witnessed it, having spent some time there. And in fact, I've probably become a vegetarian as a result of my experiences in France.
So you watched geese get force-fed, Tony?
Ago.
Tony, did you watch the geese get force-fed to make pâté?
No, I just read about it,
okay.
And I know it's happening, and I'm so glad that many parts of the world now ban it.
All right, let's get a response from Camus. Thanks for the call. Camus, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. In fact, much of my book, I talk about the ways in which I find myself romanticizing the French as being this sort of perfect group of people who have all the respect for the ingredients. But over time, I too found that the people that I was learning from in Gascony were very unique and rare. And they maybe represented an older way of thinking, but it was a waning way of thinking about food in France and really in the rest of the world. So I agree with you. I actually had the opportunity to work with a very small foie gras producer while I was there. And I went in with a lot of thoughts about foie gras. I was pretty uncomfortable with how I knew it was raised industrially. And this was right in the middle of California. I think they were in the process of outlawing foie gras at the time. So it was a very controversial debate going on. And the way that I saw them being treated, they were pasture-raised birds, and the way that I saw them do the gavage at this particular farm made me able to draw a line between the industrial model and this other model that I saw. Of course, this other model is also dying in France and is probably, I don't think we can find it in America. So again, I saw an exception to the rule, and it allowed me to really draw the lines for myself of what I was willing to eat or not eat. So I agree with you. I think there are also ways in which that process, as well as the process of meat production, can occur outside of that, in that sort of abhorrent industrial model, but they're few and far between.
Just in the book, as I was wondering what you would do with what you learned, you write of Christian Chapelard asking the very same thing. Did you know when you came back to the United States that you were going to start the Portland Meat Collective? Had the idea gelled in your mind, or did it take a while to bring that together?
It hadn't. No, I came back with very, like I said, very romantic notions about what I had seen and the model that the Chapelards had developed, and thought, oh, it'll be easy enough to just go back and start a artisanal, small, vertically integrated, you know, pork operation. And I didn't have enough brothers. I didn't have a farm to inherit. I didn't have any money. So that was, it was clear I could not do that. I thought for a while I might start a bacon cart. I mean, I just sort of had these whimsical ideas. Ended up working at a butcher shop who wanted to start sourcing whole animals from local farmers who were working outside of the industrial model and using the whole animal, and quickly learned that we didn't have a consumer base who wanted to buy the whole animal. And around that time was when I thought, oh, well, what if the kind of education I got in France was accessible to more people? Would they then start to want to buy animals or meat from these farmers, A, and B, would they be interested in using the whole animal for food?
And the answers have been?
The answer has been yes, but it's, you know, a slow cultural shift, and it's a long game, as I say in the book. But I have, you know, for almost 10 years now, I have been in the business of bringing that kind of education to people, and I've seen them change their buying and eating habits because of it.
Well, we got a wonderful tour in how you arrived at these decisions in the book. It's called Killing It, an Education. It is the work of Camis Davis, who used to edit Savour and National Geographic Adventure. Now she's the owner of the Portland Meat Collective and the executive director of the Good Meat Project. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.